Hi, everyone. This is Holly Herndon.
And Matt Dryhurst.
And you're listening to
Interdependence.
Welcome to the Interdependence Podcast, where we host conversations with some of the people we think are shaping 21st century culture. If you're hearing this, then you're listening to the shorter free version. If you're enjoying what we're doing and would like to hear the full episode, please visit patreon.com/interdependence and become a patron. In this latest episode, we talk with Professor Guy Standing, who has been at the forefront of basic income research for over 30 years, running pilots all over the world. We discuss his original concept of the precariat, a new class that might be familiar to many listeners, the moral case for a basic income, and his vision of a future of a new left built on Enlightenment principles. Okay, great. So we were hoping that you might be willing to introduce yourself.
I see. That's probably a good start. Well, my name is Guy Standing. I'm an economist with a PhD from the University of Cambridge, and I have been director at the International Labour Organization, UN body, and then a professor of economics at various universities. But I've spent most of the last 20 years mainly writing, so I see myself very much as a writer. And I've been speaking on my books all over the world, I think over 500 presentations on the themes we're going to discuss. And it seems increasingly topical. So I've been extremely busy during this coronavirus lockdown period.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, as you mentioned, you've written several books around the topics that we're going to discuss today. And you've also introduced some new terms to a larger audience, one of which is The Precariat, which is also the name of one of your books. So we thought it would be really great to start with maybe a definition of who is the precariat and how is this a new class?
Well, I think it's very important to give the context for the development of the precariat, because the world and all of the societies that we're covering have been going through what I've called a global transformation, the painful construction of a global market economy. And it started with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan back in the early 1980s in what economists have called neoliberalism, which has become a pejorative term. But neoliberalism was essentially an attempt to turn the global economic system into a market-driven one. But strangely enough, what it's done is morph into what I've called rentier capitalism. What that means in a non-technical way is that more and more of the income in the world is flowing to the possessors of property, financial property most of all, physical property and intellectual property. And as a result, less and less income and wealth is going to people who rely on labor and work. And that has created a very fragile economic system and a new class structure. And the new class structure has a plutocracy at the top, a salariat in salaried jobs as along with benefits and so on, pensions in prospect and so on. And the old industrial working class, the proletariat, has been shrinking, and the precariat has emerged underneath that. And that's a long way of saying that the precariat is a new emerging class of people defined by three dimensions, not one. First of all, they have very distinctive, what some people call relations of production. What that means is various forms of unstable labor. They have to do a lot of work that doesn't get counted as labor, doesn't get remunerated. They have to have indirect employment relations, often called self-employed or gig or what, all these terms. But for me, that is not the most important aspect of being in the precariat. More importantly, the people in the precariat, don't have an occupational narrative or identity that they can give to themselves as they go through life. They're scrabbling around with bits and pieces. One day they may be an artist, another day they may be a barman, another day they may be cleaning floors, and the next day they might be an artist again. So there's a sense of sort of insecurity in their occupational identity. But very importantly, the precariat has distinctive relations of distribution. And what that means is they have to rely very largely on money wages that are uncertain, fluctuate a lot. They don't get access to benefits, non-wage benefits, or reliable state benefits. And they also are subject to exploitative relations by people taking rent income from them through debt. So most people in the precariat have high levels of near unsustainable debt. They're living from one paycheck or one income gig account or whatever it might be. And then the third thing, which is very important to appreciate, is that if you're in the precariat, you have distinctive relations to the state. And what that means is that you're losing rights. You feel that you're not a full citizen. You feel like a denizen. You feel as if you're losing social rights. You don't get access to civil rights, to due process in front of the law. You don't have cultural rights that give you a sense of belonging and security, and you don't have economic rights. So this combination of things produces a very set of mixed sentiments and health problems and challenges. And fundamentally, people in the precariat find themselves scrabbling around to have some sense of community, some sense of reciprocity and mutual aid background, and we'll come back to that later. But the precariat is something that is growing all over the world. I've been invited to speak about the precariat in over 40 countries, including China and Japan and many other countries. And it's growing, and people are in the precariat in almost every occupation. It exists in the musical industry. It exists in education. It exists in the medical professions. It exists in the legal professions. You will find the class structure that I've described earlier in every occupational group. And that, I think, is an extraordinary feature. So there's a precariat in the legal profession. You cannot talk about all lawyers being in the salariat or in the elite. Some are, but many are in paralegal situations that put them in chronic insecurity. They know what the precariat is. And one of the reasons why I've had so many easy gigs, if you like, with journalists is that many journalists are part of the precariat and they know all about it. And that's, I think it's a really widespread thing. But the last point I want to make is that until fairly recently, it's been internally divided between an atavistic group who are less educated and they've been pushed from old working class communities, families or whatever. And this group tends to listen to the populists, the Trumps, the Boris Johnsons, the Brexit debate. They support very worrying populist movements. Then although the migrants, millions of migrants are in the precariat and they just keep their heads down. And the group that I reach out to most are what I call the progressives. They go to university, they go to college and they come out and they don't feel they have a future. Because their parents and teachers told them if they went to university, they would have a future, they would have a career. But they come out and they don't feel that they've got that future. And this group is looking for this politics of paradise we'll come back to that is not been there until it's emerging, but it's taking time to take shape. You can see the contours. You can see many of the developments, the movements that are emerging from this progressive part of the precariat. And I'm quietly optimistic that even in this darkest moment with the pandemic and the slump that's being linked to it, that the precariat is beginning to find its collective identity and mojo, if you like.
I would say so. I mean, as we, I think, presaged in the document that we shared, this term already resonated with us a few years ago upon reading the book, but it just feels like, given the opportunity to revisit it, it feels incredibly prescient. And the good news is we can kind of share that that feeling, in a sense that, you know, musicians or artists, in fact, there's been a number of articles in the past couple of weeks even, in which people are beginning to notice that musicians are starting to see themselves as workers. Indeed, like
gig workers, gig
economy. Yeah, synonymous with this kind of gig economy, and beginning to see that, of course, when the kind of fairy dust economy of, you know, living paycheck to paycheck stops as COVID kind of accelerated or enforced, that they, similar to all their friends, who many of whom did go to university, they don't have any assets, right?
Yeah,
it's like
right.
this kind of check to check scenario. I mean, as you put it earlier, actually, like, some people have gardens, other people don't. And so it feels like there is a kind of class consciousness that's being engendered by this. And this precariat diagnosis is the closest I can see to being something new, right? Because traditional working class identities don't necessarily scan or match perfectly with whatever this new thing is that we have.
Right.
Right.
I mean, I think one of the interesting things I've found over the years that I've been writing and talking about the precariat is how little the old left, the old social democrats and labor unionists really understand the precariat. And as I've mentioned many times when I'm discussing it with trade unionists, I said often, if I'm talking to a large group of people who identify themselves as part of the precariat, if there's one way I could drive them all to go rushing to the bar and get some drinks, is if I start talking about trade unions, because they feel that the agenda and imagery of traditional labor unions just doesn't gel with, particularly with this progressive part of the precariat. We do not want to go back to the dour imagery of a life of 30 years of the same boring job and jobs and jobs. That is not what really motivates or inspires the precariat. They're wanting to work. They're wanting to be creative. They want to be experimenting. They want to be developing their potential and linking up with nature. There's very close ecological feeling in being part of the precariat. It's about confronting the mechanisms that oppress and exploit us, if you like, without wanting to go back to a dour laborism. And I don't think that the old social democrats understand that, because their answer to the precariat is to try and push everybody back into full-time jobs. Well, that wouldn't solve the existential appeal of being a creative person. And for me, this is why it is a dangerous class, because it doesn't relate to the old models of the 1960s or 1970s, and it doesn't relate to the neoliberal rentier capitalism model, which it finds revolting. It is looking for a new politics, a new set of mechanisms, of institutions, mechanisms that can enable us to realize the artist in us at the same time as wanting to work, wanting to relate to our care desires, our community desires, and our ecological impulses. There's a different agenda there. And I don't like the thought of seeing the precariat simply as victims. It's not as simple as that. It's not as simple as that. And that's why I get quite annoyed still when a lot of people write and criticize me for saying, you know, there's nothing new, they say. Well, it is new. There's this combination of characteristics and the structure around the precariat and the fact that we do not see the answer as going back to being everybody being in full-time jobs for years and years. That I think is an interesting aspect of the whole debate.
Yeah, and I think I agree. I mean, I think it also underestimates the scale of the challenge, right? Because at least we've spent a lot of time looking, for example, at, you know, the rise of Silicon Valley and the platform economy. And one of the undeniable features that is, I mean, if you look at the history of that, obviously, right, you had a bunch of very well-capitalized companies basically displacing institutions that would provide that long-term stability in favor of a narrative of kind of individual access or individual kind of expression, right?
Yeah.
And while part of the reason we call this podcast Interdependence versus Independence is that our diagnosis is that many of the kind of the necessary maybe displacing of institutions that happened in the 20th century, right, of people all of a sudden being able to break free and create their own distribution networks or, you know, do things outside of traditional, in many cases, conservative institutions. In some senses, a lot of the kind of the mythology of that has been used by the Ubers and the Facebooks of the world to kind of sell their services, right? And unless you would kind of acknowledge that it is kind of useful now that everybody has in their pocket a computer that enables them to organize and perhaps create new institutions, it's going to be very, very hard to get anyone on board, right?
Well, I think that's right. I think the interesting thing about that discourse is that this is the disembedded phase of the global transformation. And what that means in simple terms is that the economic and technological developments led to the economy, the economic dynamism, getting out of control of society. We don't have the social institutions that protect us as commoners in society. And what has happened is big tech, big pharma, big finance, Goldman Sachs, and so on, have been able to take the rental incomes. And they did that partly with the intellectual property rights revolution in the 1990s. And they've done it through lobbying and effectively getting control of the state. And what that has meant is that those people who've been in charge of the technological revolution and AI as well have been gaining vastly most of the income and wealth. And the platform economy that's emerged, it's a term I prefer to the gig economy. I don't like the term gig economy because it suggests everybody's having a lot of fun and they're all going from gig to gig and we're all playing good music and having some great sex at the end of it. But it's not that. I mean, the platform economy is very much driven by the rent seekers and labor brokers. The owners of the apps take 25%, 35%, 50% in some cases of every transaction. So they're basically rentiers. They're taking the surplus, exploiting both the customer and the tasker, as I've called them. So to me, that set of things that has come up is demanding new institutions, new mechanisms, new voice mechanisms, a new system of income distribution to embed this economic dynamism. And then we can welcome AI. We can welcome these apps. They are liberating potentially. But at the moment, the whole electronic revolution, including, you know, Facebook, YouTube, and the big tech, are dominating us, limiting our freedom, limiting our capabilities to be creative and politically savvy and so on, and are manipulating us, and the surveillance capitalism that's coming along as well, the panopticon state, as I called it, is very much to the fore. So we are in a situation of a dark moment, and particularly as we see the events in the United States at the moment, a dark moment when it could go to an authoritarian, very fascistic situation, or we could have a popular movement to demand changes in the income distribution system, changes in the structures of voice and so on, and due process, the legal matters of due process back in the center of our discourse. At the moment, we're on a very dangerous point when it could go either way, which is scary.
Yeah, I mean, that really resonates with us as musicians, I think, regarding the kind of like streaming economy that I think we'll get into a little bit later. I think it would be really useful to talk about basic income now, though, because, you know, it's kind of one mechanism that you propose as a kind of redistribution. And you've kind of made it, I guess, your life's work dealing with the topic for over 30 years. And in some interviews, I was listening to some podcasts with you this past week, and I noticed that it's a very kind of deeply personal topic for you. And so for people who are unfamiliar with what basic income is, can you just briefly tell us, you know, how would you define it? And how did you come across the concept initially?
Well, you're right. It is my lifetime work, if you like. And I've been advocating basic income since the early 1980s. So that dates me. And I've been very fortunate in the sense that I'm one of the few people who's had a chance to put what you believe in into practice. I've been involved in designing and implementing pilots, experiments in various parts of the world over the last 20 years in particular. And therefore, you know, I've seen how it works. A basic income is literally a simple matter of saying that every individual in society should have the right to basic security, secured by a modest basic income paid in cash regularly as a right, an economic right, without behavioral conditionality. You don't have to do X, Y, or Z in order to get it. It's non-withdrawable. It's individual, vitally important that it's paid to an individual woman, an individual man equally, with a smaller amount for children. And it's essentially non-withdrawable. Now, for me, the reasons for supporting having everybody have a basic income, and I don't call it a universal basic income because you'd have to have practical rules for entitlement by migrants coming into society. You need to support migrants, but they should have to stay in the country for a certain time before they become eligible. Plus, somebody living outside his or her country would not be receiving it inside the country. So it's not quite right to call it universal. But the reason I always supported it, and I've argued this in my books, is fundamentally ethical. And the threefold ethical justification is, first of all, that it's a matter of common justice. And this goes back to the foundational document of the British Constitution, which was sealed on November the 6th, 1217, and it's called the Charter of the Forest. And the Charter of the Forest asserted that everybody had the right to subsistence in a life in the commons, and a right to access the means of providing their own subsistence and the means of ensuring their basic subsistence. And you can argue that the wealth and income of all of us is far more to do with the efforts and achievements that we've inherited from the many, many, many generations before us than anything we do ourselves. But if you accept private inheritance of wealth, which all governments do, which is a lot of something for nothing for an elite, then you should allow for the idea of a basic income being a social dividend paid to everybody, because we don't know whose ancestors, yours, mine, others, contributed more or less to our collective wealth. So to say that a basic income is a social dividend, a small return that would give people basic security, I think is a fundamental ethical principle. If you're religious, I'm not religious, but if you are religious, then you could say God gives us unequal talents and a basic income system would be compensating those without the talent of making money to have an equal life. Now, for basic income, it people say, well, why give it to the rich as well as to the poor? Well, it's much more efficient, much more equitable to give everybody a basic income. And then you increase the tax rate to get the money back or whatever you want, higher up the income scale. It's much better to do it that way than to try and identify the poor and then find out who's poor, who's not poor, and give it to the poor. Very quickly, you have to say, well, if they're lazy, where should they get it? And then you have tests and that. But what happens is you also create a poverty trap so that anybody who's getting it because they're poor, if they make an effort to become non-poor, they lose the benefits and therefore have a disincentive to take low-wage jobs and so on. So for me, it's much more efficient as well as equitable. It will also enhance freedom. And that's very important. That's an ethical principle. It enhances the freedom to say no to an exploiter or an oppressor. And that, I think, is one of the biggest findings we have in our surveys. We did a pilot in Africa. And at the end of the pilot, after 2 years, I went down to some of the rural areas and I asked some young women, I said, please tell me, what's the best thing for you? Having had a basic income for this period, what's the best thing? And to start with, they were shy and they didn't want to say anything. Oh, they were a bit nervous and, you know, speaking to a foreigner and all that. But then one of them chirped up and said, I'll tell you why. The best thing is before, when the men came down from the fields at the end of the month with their wages in their pockets, we had to say yes. Now we have our basic income, we can say no. Now that's powerful. It's an emancipatory position. And you can give many examples. But it's also a freedom to be moral. You can't be moral if you're forced by circumstances to behave in certain ways because you're so desperate to feed your child, to pay your debts or something. You can't be moral. You can only be moral if you have the freedom to make decisions for yourself and for your family and for your community. And basic income does that. And the final thing is that a basic income, by definition, even if it's a modest one, as we found, gives people basic security. And basic security is a human need. It's a human need. It's a public good and a human need. And people who don't have basic security in themselves, in their relationships, they suffer from a diminishing mental bandwidth. What that means, basically, is their IQ goes down. It's a simple statistical fact that that's what happens. People's ability to be rational and make decisions is compromised by chronic insecurity. And anybody who's experienced chronic insecurity knows damn well what that means. And a basic income is a human right because you can't be rational unless you have an IQ that is in tune with yourself. So I think the ethical justification, and now with the pandemic, it's become an economic imperative, as I've argued in various articles in the last few weeks, because the vulnerability of all of us is going to depend on the vulnerability of the weakest sections of our society. And all the schemes that governments have been introducing, like the job retention scheme in Britain or the wage subsidies in various countries, have been protecting not the poorest and most vulnerable in the precariat. They've been protecting the salaried people and giving much more to middle income earners than they have been to the precariat. And that will leave large numbers of people exposed and vulnerable to a second round of the coronavirus pandemic and social illnesses that are multiplying at this very moment. So I think that basic income is now becoming an imperative if we're to get out of this pandemic slump.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also interesting as well, maybe a slight detour, but on COVID specifically, you know, the identification of essential workers seems to be like one really, you know, like the language of the precariat or the 1% has been introduced over the past decade or so and has become really useful. And I feel like if there's one kind of terminology that might endure beyond COVID is this idea of essential workers, right? When at the end of the day, you know, there are people who are arguably some of the most disenfranchised by the economy who are out there doing the hard work, keeping everyone's lights on, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are two aspects to that, Matt. One is that the essential workers are many, 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 many people. And it's very arbitrary to decide who is essential and who is non-essential. You can do it roughly. I would say financiers are non-essential and care workers are essential. Let's start at that point. But you know the point I'm making. It is essentially arbitrary. But a very, very important aspect, which I've tried to emphasize in the precariat books, is that if you're in the precariat, you have to do a lot of work that doesn't get counted as labor. And the ridiculous nature of our statistics is the fact, simple fact, that if I had the good fortune of hiring Holly as a housekeeper, national income goes up, jobs go up, economic growth goes up, and the unemployment rate goes down. If we then decided after a few weeks to get married, and she continues to do exactly the same work, national income goes down, employment goes down, the number of jobs goes down, the unemployment rate goes up, and the economic growth is deteriorating. And that's absolutely absurd. It's absolutely stupid. And what that means, it's very sexist, because all the work that women in particular have been doing over the ages in caring for children, in caring for the elderly, in caring for people who are sick, is completely regarded as non-work. It's not remunerated, it's not protected, it's not treated well by trade unions, you know, a labor law, etc. It's just completely invisible, which is ridiculous. And I think that this pandemic is not only showing that the essential workers, nurses, auxiliaries, care workers and so on are fundamental to society, but is also exposing the idiocy of treating unpaid care as non-existent. Because this pandemic is showing how vital care work of all sorts is. And I'm strongly advocating that we need a major radical overhaul of our labor statistics, our economic statistics. It's ridiculous that care work doesn't get counted in our economic statistics. But in fact, the Office of National Statistics in Britain and other countries have started doing it too, have estimated that the value of all unpaid care work is £1.2 trillion per year, which is more than the value created by all manufacturing and non-financial services in the economy. So in other words, you're leaving out Hamlet, really, in looking at the play. And it is absurd. It's just completely absurd. And I'm really putting a lot of effort into saying that this must be confronted by an overhaul in the way we look at work, or the way we look at the activities that we do, fundamentally changing the conceptualization of reality to a much closer image that is closer to reality, the real reality. And I think the precariat discourse allows one to be moving in that direction. And the basic income, of course, would allow us to spend more time doing the care without being unable to do so because we haven't got any money to pay for our food. And I think it would tilt the balance of how we allocate our time between labor and doing jobs. We still have jobs to do, but many bullshit jobs are not worth doing and don't contribute to happiness of anybody except the boss, but also enable us to spend more time doing voluntary work, doing community work, doing ecological work, clearing up in nature, helping care for our neighbors and so on. So it would lead to reorientation. And in the process, of course, allowing for more creativity in our relationships, in our work, and in our leisure. And I think a basic income could help us recapture the real ancient Greek sense of chole, which is public participation and leisure, that sense of being living in the polis, in the agora, and participating as a public citizen. And I think that's vital for artists. It's vital for all of us. And, you know, I always remember Picasso's famous aphorism, every child is an artist. The difficulty is to retain the artistry when they become adults. And that sense in which we are all wanting to be more artistic in the way we live our lives and the way we combine activities. I don't think a person can be a good writer unless he's something else. Don't think an artist, if he's just 100% focusing on whatever art it is, he's not going to be an enriching artist. I think we need a combination of activities, and that's so important. But we must do it in the context of basic security. Because if you don't have basic security, you become a zombie very quickly, and you start self-destructing, suicidal tendencies, morbidity, cardiac problems, cancers, and so on. So this is a systemic challenge we're facing.
I think I agree. And another thing that when we were writing, putting our notes together, that, you know, you'd say is far less important to acknowledge than care work. So I do want to acknowledge that. But ultimately, how much these points also speak to a condition we see related specifically to social media, where that's a really thorny area, right? Because in a way, social media is sold as a means of personal expression. But in actuality, you know, you see people participating in platforms most often as supplicants, as you would put it, right? This is all the kind of like subtle or unsubtle labor that goes into basically advertising yourself as part of a marketplace, which is the subtext we see with social media generally, right? It's like people don't have leisure time. Instead, they, you know, they're invited to kind of sell their opinions or be like a constant presence online in the hope that in doing so they might find opportunities for themselves. And it becomes really, really tricky, right? Because again, they're like the language of like personal expression, artistry, leisure, interests, passions, all of these things have kind of been folded into work.
Well, even your holiday photos become part of your kind of personal brand, yeah, that's which right. then goes into your business.
Yeah. I wrote a book which was published last year called Plunder of the Commons. And I regard the intellectual commons, the knowledge commons, the information commons, the education commons, as a collective area of human existence, which is under incredible threat at the moment. I mean, the idea of intellectual commons is that ideas are part of society. We inherit ideas. You having an idea doesn't deprive me of having the idea. The sense of access to information must be broad so that we can have access to a variety of opinions, a variety of sources of information. And fundamentally, it goes back, we must need an education commons in which we all can have access to knowledge without being indoctrinated and fed into silos of blind ignorance because we are only getting reinforcing messages from one direction or another. And I think, you know, the combination of the threat to the commons, which has been privatized, it's been commodified, it's been dominated by plutocratic corporations and interests, and we all know we're being manipulated on the internet, we're being manipulated by Facebook and YouTube and Amazon and the various others who are feeding us stuff that we don't subliminally often and that we don't feel in control of. And of course, they are using us for their advertising revenue. Every time we go on the computer, we're feeding data to them without us knowing it, or let alone giving our approval. And artistically, it means that it's a really big challenge, whether you're a musician, you're a poet, you're a writer, or any of the other arts, to provide a subversive counter narrative to this incredible dominating, domineering system that's been built up that is depriving us of our commons. And it is one of the biggest challenges we're facing altogether. I mean, you can't understand the continuing hold of an evil man like Trump without understanding how people are being manipulated and how diseducated many of us, or maybe all of us, have become. And it is really frightening that things like sound bites and slogans and pithy, simplistic lies are fed into the system. I happened to spend a day with Boris Johnson early last year in private. We had a series of arguments. And at the end of the day, I said to myself, I have never had a long discussion with anybody who's told more lies in the course of 4 or 5 hours than I could have imagined. And here he is, now he's prime minister, and he's known, it's well known, he got dismissed as a journalist because he kept telling lies. He's habitual, it's sort of ingrained. But how can it, our standards have dropped to the point we, enough people can be induced to support somebody who doesn't even abide by the lowest common denominator of moral behavior. Telling the truth. And I think we're in a dangerous spot here because artists and art has always had a duty to shine the light of truth to power and to feed us with a different narrative and a way of objecting, rebelling, if you like, to the dominant narrative. And today, with the electronic power that's against us, that means that art has an even greater responsibility than it's had historically. And at the moment, it's extremely difficult because our education system has turned into a commodified, privatized system of giving privilege to some and schooling and rote learning to others, and has broken down in the enlightenment function that the best traditions of education have meant to serve. So it is part of the same process. This loss of the commons, for me, is a really fundamental part of our challenge. And of course, as I argued in the book, the reason I started the book was that it relates to the precariat, because the precariat needs the commons. It needs the natural commons. It needs the social commons, social housing.
Can I just interject for 1 second? Can we just, for the sake of the listener, can we just define quickly what you mean when you say the commons? I don't think that that's necessarily obvious to everyone who maybe isn't familiar with your
work. No, the commons goes back to early history. A commons is something that is not privately owned. It's not state owned. It's not owned by anybody. It exists as a sharing system, a communal body of activities, reciprocities. And you talk about a commons, it's not just a commons that you have out a piece of land that is accessible to a certain number of people to go and graze their sheep or anything like that. It relates to what is being built up that belongs to everybody and belongs to nobody. So a commons, in terms of our social commons, for example, The National Health Service, to give an example of a social commons, was set up in 1948. And by convention over the hundreds of years, something that is shared, a system that is shared, that lasts for 20 years or more, becomes part of the inherited commons. And the NHS became part of our commons in Britain in 1968 by that definition. That's a pragmatic definition, but it's always been a matter of social memory, as something that is inherited as part of our sharing mechanisms. The same with common law. Common law is something that we share as equals, so that in principle, a common law system is we're all equal before the law and we all are owed due process, that we can have representation, we can have independent judges, independent processes, we can support ourselves or have representation. The loss of the commons has hit the precariat incredibly hard all over the world in the last 20 years. And therefore, for example, with welfare systems, you have bureaucrats who can sanction people, take away their livelihoods, impoverish them by a whim, a decision that they don't have to be answerable to any due process. The person who gets sanctioned, who loses their benefits, has had no right to a fair trial. It's a decision that's made. It's a shocking thing because it's not a minor matter to those people. It's a major matter. If you suddenly lose your benefit and you have no other source of income, what happens? You're out in the street. And millions of people, not just in one or two countries, in many, many countries, have lost the common law. They've lost the sense of being a citizen. That's what I was talking about earlier. And the commons, it embraces so much of our institutional structure. And in this century in particular, it's been subject to privatization. It's been subject to commodification. It's been subject to financialization, where financial corporations take over large parts of our cities now, are owned by private equity. I mean, it's ridiculous that large parts of central London and many other cities are no longer part of our commons, but they're owned by some foreign bank or something who turn them into private. They're called POPs, privately owned public spaces, POPs. And you can go through so many different areas that were traditionally part of our commons and part of our society. Traditionally, the commons were called the poor's overcoat. The poor's overcoat. And that symbolized the point that in extremis, you would have access to the social amenities, the social networks, which would give you the means of survival. And if you take away the commons, then people lose resilience, they lose security, they lose the capacity to be citizens. And that's what's been happening.
Yeah, I want to go back for a minute on when you were talking a little bit about care work. I was thinking about the author Helen Hester. Do you know her work? Do you remember the name of her book, Matt?
I don't remember the name of her book, but she works with the Autonomy Institute.
Yeah,
But yeah, it was making me think about a talk where I was listening to you, and I think you were talking about a Hayekian neoliberal concept where nothing has a value unless you can give it a price. Right. Which is a really kind of insidious concept.
Correct.
And, you know, as musicians, we're kind of dealing with the rentier capitalist streaming companies such as Spotify setting the price for music based on the frequency on which the music is played, which to me is a really, really strange logic, because the best art can't be valued based on the number of times you want to experience it necessarily.
Right.
And it feels as if the kind of, the system is somehow rigged in Spotify's favor. What flatters Spotify as a platform then kind of becomes the norm.
Yeah, I mean, this is what you just described as a classic piece of rentier capitalism. And it reminded me that I've been invited across to Silicon Valley a number of times and to Los Angeles and to speak to executives of some of the big tech corporations, billionaires and all of them. And I was giving a talk on rentier capitalism and the precariat in Los Angeles. And Towards the end of my talk, a big man who is a multi-billionaire, and he's one of the big shots in Silicon Valley, I won't give his name, he stood up and he came towards me where I was standing, and I thought he was going to hit me. And he came up and he stood in front of me and he said, "Guy, are you saying that the system is rigged in our favor?" And I looked at him and I said, "Yes, I am saying that." And he said, "Well, I agree with you. I totally agree with you. And it can't continue because we're winning too much. We're taking too much."
Wow.
And that's because there's nobody stopping us.
If you're hearing this, then you're listening to the shorter free version. If you're enjoying what we're doing and would like to hear the full episode, please visit patreon.com/interdependence and become a patron.